This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Here to discuss the week in politics is Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield with the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good to see you both.
Thanks. Good to be here.
A new state legislature was seated on Wednesday. Status quo at the top. Phil Berger will again lead the Senate. Tim Moore gets another term as Speaker of the House. Beneath that, however, plenty of change. There are nearly 40 lawmakers in new posts. This includes two lawmakers who shifted chambers, two Muslims, more women in office, and the departure of several prominent Republican incumbents. Who or what should listeners know about the new slate of lawmakers? Rob.
There's some interesting progressive additions to the General Assembly, some interesting folks. Allison Dahl here from Wake County is a lesbian woman who was her election was aided, of course, by the Me Too movement and Dwayne Hall's disgrace that took place last year. There's Zach Hawkins, who's a new Durham representative who took veteran Mickey Michaud's place. Mickey, of course, has been in there for decades, so that'll be a shift. Rachel Hunt, this daughter of former Governor Hunt with a very powerful pedigree and some controversy around the margin of her victory. Julie von Hafen, maybe representing sort of the teachers movement that was so prominent last spring in the General Assembly, who took Nelson Dollar's seat in here from Wake County. And Senator Mohammed, Mujtaba Mohammed, I'm probably not pronouncing his name right, a new Asian American lawmaker from the Charlotte area, I believe. And there's a new group here in North Carolina called North Carolina Asian Americans Together. And the fact that we now have two Asian Americans in the Senate is an interesting development. So those are some interesting.
And I would only quickly note that senator, I believe, is a millennial. There are not very many millennials in that building either.
There you go.
Yeah, not many millennials. But, you know, some interesting things. It's almost like the new class has joined the General Assembly. You know, if you think back to your college or school years, one thing that I found particularly interesting is that of the 39 new members, 14 of them have local government experience, whether that's county commission, school board. We have a former sheriff that's coming in. I always think it's interesting. I always feel like those members have a little bit of a step ahead just because they have dealt with government budgets and the structure of government and have an idea of the different responsibilities that government have. So I think, you know, I mean, one thing that I'm seeing with it is we've got 14 seasoned elected officials, you know, that I think will bring their experience to the General Assembly. Rob mentioned some things. We also have two pastors that are going to be joining the House, which could put some interesting things into the discussion. We may need a lot of praying during this during the session. We're seeing that. Some other things, the newly elected Senator Harper Peterson, Democrat from New Hanover County, has been a very active voice in the Gen X water contamination question. So that's surely going to come up again. Senator Sam Searcy, here in Wake County, another Democrat that's recently been seated, is a vodka distillery owner. And one thing that we're going to be looking at the John Locke Foundation in this session is some ABC reforms. And so I'm interested to talk to him about perhaps some ideas that he might have, again, as a vodka distillery owner. So it's always fun. It's kind of like the beginning of school when you get to know new classmates and that kind of thing. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a little bit more diverse body. And again, the big thing is Republicans have lost the supermajority, and so there's going to be, I think, the discussion and the way things go and operate are going to be a little bit different, with Governor Cooper perhaps having a little bit more influence.
On the topic of diversity, there are no African-American Republicans in either chamber, and there was a tweet this week that caught my attention. We're going to loop in some context from Capitol Hill. In 1989, there were 29 women in the U.S. House, 16 Democrats, 13 Republicans. In 2019, there are now 102 women in the U.S. House, 89 Democrats, and still 13 Republicans. Becky, does the GOP have either a gender or a diversity problem?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that it's a diversity problem. I mean, people choose to run for office for lots of different reasons. You know, one of the things, you know, as Rob mentioned, we have a newly elected, I think it's the House member who is a lesbian. We have people that have been interested in the teacher movement. We even have a weather website operator coming in. So, you know, again, the Gen X water contamination, I know gun rights have been an issue for at least one of these members. So people run and are elected for office for all kinds of different reasons. You know, I'll be honest with you, with the current political environment and as nasty as it is, I'm sort of puzzled why anybody runs for public office these days.
None of the three of us have.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, I will say that in the era of Donald Trump, I think it's very difficult to recruit people of color and women to run. It's harder to recruit them to run as Republicans. Holly Grange, who's a Republican lawmaker, was quoted this week as saying, of course, on my side, there's not a whole lot of diversity. It can be referred to as a middle-aged white man's club, I guess. That's what she said, and she's a Republican woman. So that's obviously a problem for Republicans. And I feel like I say this every week, Donald Trump influences so much of our modern American politics, and I feel that his overt racism, his overt sexism are a problem when he is the standard bearer for your party.
The latest allegations of ethical violations against Speaker Tim Moore emerged this week in a News and Observer piece. It was reported that a member of Moore's staff contacted state inspectors about environmental issues pertaining to part of a private land deal. Moore said this week to a group of reporters he didn't know anything about that call made by one of his advisors until he read about it in the paper. Then, speaking with reporters earlier this week, he provided a letter from the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement, which dismissed the complaint from earlier in 2018. Rob, satisfied?
Well, no. I think Speaker Moore has a problem, and that is, I think, an inherent problem when anybody is in such a powerful position, and then on the side, in their law practice or their business dealings, they are negotiating with state regulators for their own personal private gain. That raises some really fundamental questions of almost an inherent conflict of interest. And there have been multiple complaints against Speaker Moore. We think there will be more. We're told more will be filed soon. And we know that and to make it just that much a little bit more complex, the person in question here who made the call to the state regulators is himself a former legislator who had gone to work for that agency. And then when the Democrats, Cooper, took office, he came back to work for Speaker Moore. This is Gillespie, right?
Mitch Gillespie, right. We're not trying to hide his name.
Yeah. Former state rep. So, boy, you know, I just think Speaker Moore needs to be very careful with this kind of stuff. It's one thing for sort of a rank and file member who's a backbencher to have, you know, who's trying to get by on a minimal public salary to have a personal dealings with the government on the side. It raises issues. But when it's one of the most powerful people in the state and somebody in their office is calling up a state regulator and saying, hey, what's the status of that business deal my boss is involved with? It doesn't look good. Even if there wasn't any corruption, it certainly has some bad appearances.
Well, I think it's important to remember that there have been complaints filed. I think one reason why there have been complaints filed against Speaker Moore is because he is the Speaker of the House. He's a much bigger target. And as Rob said, I mean, there is a fiduciary duty, and I think we all agree with that. But I think it's also important to remember that the Ethics Board have cleared him of almost all of these. I think there's one or two more that are pending, but, you know, there have been numerous complaints that have been filed, and the Ethics Board has cleared him of these. And so I think we need to remember, too, that due process and, you know, having an investigation, when you're cleared of an investigation, that's it, and it ought to be enough.
Am I right that the Wake County DA is also investigating on
I don't have that in front of me, but I believe there is another issue that is still out there. It's a non-criminal investigation,
non-criminal
if my memory
serves.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not suggesting that everything has been dismissed. What I'm saying is that most of the complaints have been dismissed. Investigations are continuing. If there's something there, we certainly should get to the bottom of it, but I think we need to be careful not to make accusations, particularly when he's been cleared of many of these charges.
We in the media don't like to be part of the story, but we're going to be part of this next story. For the first time since the legislature opened in 1963, the press room is set to be put underground in the basement. The man who runs the building, Paul Coble, has ordered the move. While it appears state law would require Phil Berger and Tim Moore to sign off on this, they have effectively punted for now, saying they've delegated the decision to him. Full disclosure, I am currently the president of the Capitol Press Corps and am in the middle of this whole thing. The new room would result in a reduction of space, about 25% square footage, as well as a reduction in access for the working press. In the moment we're in, with frequent attacks against the Fourth Estate, how significant is this looming move, Rob?
I think it's very significant and troubling. I think it's also emblematic. Well, first of all, as you say, I think that the real issue here is that people who don't know how the legislative building is set up might not have a grip of this, but where the press room has been in a place where it's very centrally located, easy access, easy for people to walk in and engage with the press, right across from the press conference room there on the first floor of the legislative building. So that's a practical issue that I think is a causes a problem. But I would argue that the legislative building in general in recent years has become less of the people's house. I think Colin Campbell wrote a good column on this recently, The Insider, that this is less the people's house. We've done away with tabling by outside groups who used to be able to make reservations and use parts of the legislative building to promote their nonprofit or their good government group. We've installed metal detectors. I would argue, made the sergeant-at-arms have adopted a much more hostile adversarial relationship towards the public in recent years. I recognize times have changed. It's not the same as it was 25, 26 years ago when I first arrived in Raleigh, but it's definitely a less welcoming, less open place that doesn't feel nearly as much like the House of the People anymore.
Well, I agree with Rob. I think it is less welcoming, and I think that is due to security concerns. And we've seen this escalate over the last several years. The Moral Monday protest that took place over the last several years, I mean, I was down at the building. It was pretty scary, you know, to be honest with you.
But there was violence with those protests. There was certainly a need for
security and ramped up security. I mean, Paul Coble, who is in charge of the legislative building, is charged with the safety of not only every legislator in that building, but also constituents and people that are visiting that building. So it is less welcoming. I think it's a shame. I think lots of places are less welcoming because of the security concerns that we have, and the North Carolina General Assembly building is no different than any others. I also agree with Rob's point, and I think yours as well, Jeff, is, you know, I've been disappointed in the non-disclosure, sort of the secrecy around the change. As I've watched this kind of unfold, and you mentioned there's 25% less space, but also the press corps is a lot less than it was in 1963. There are fewer people there. There also are more demands with technology. And what little bit of information that we have on this, understand that there's going to be technological improvements in it to do that. Now, you know, we'll see. And I know you
which is news to me, and I will just interject, and I apologize for interrupting you, but this is something that Senator Berger said when we questioned him just about the general move on the floor of the Senate yesterday. He pivoted to, this was needed for technological reasons. There are going to be technological upgrades, which is the very first I had heard that. I mean, at one point, the press was billed, this was billed to us as this is going to be an upgrade. When it was first told to us, and I don't think very much of this is public right now, but when it was first told us that we were moving, we were told that we were no longer going to have hardline internet, hardline phones, or the audio connections that we presently have. I'm just adding this for context. I know you don't know this. I had to lobby and fight on our behalf just to maintain status quo in terms of technology. So when I heard that yesterday, I was confused more than anything. When I heard technology upgrades, I mean, that's not what's happening here.
Like the General Assembly leaders could have done a much better job and should still do a much better job of actually engaging and discussing with reporters and with the Capitol Press Corps about what they need to do a good job to tell the story. The public has a right to know everything that's going on in that building. And you're right, this is an era in which the media has been under assault, often by public leaders, often public leaders of the party that's running the General Assembly. And I think there's a natural concern that this is a step to generally control the media and keep reporting to a minimum.
But I think we need to keep an eye on it, and I think we need to hope for a good outcome, mm-hmm. and one that increases the ability of the press and the media. I mean, you know, the organization I work for, John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal, you know, is a reporting, mm-hmm. You know, and certainly Rob's organization as well. So we're big advocates for that. And I wish that the General Assembly were a little more open about it. But Jeff, with you at the helm, with the leadership, with the press corps, I have all the confidence in the world that a great resolution is going to come of this.
I appreciate that.
We love you, Jeff.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to add on the back end before we go to one more question. And I will say this, it will live probably only on the web, but one of the big questions surrounding this whole thing, which we have not yet addressed here today, is, well, why? Why would you move the press corps? And that is a question we posed for 2 months. And eventually we had a bigger meeting last month, and eventually, after much nagging and pushing, we were told that it was needed for member meeting space. So lawmakers need it for meeting space. And the only caveat I would add to that is that there are plenty of rooms,
dozens of rooms
in the legislative complex that are underutilized at this point. But we'll move on. This is something that I think we might talk about again in the next couple of weeks. Shifting to Capitol Hill, now almost 3 weeks into a partial federal government shutdown with no end in sight that I'm aware of, what is the most significant effect on North Carolina, Becky?
A couple things. Of course, federal workers who are here in North Carolina know that they are eligible for unemployment benefits in North Carolina. And as a matter of fact, on the website, there are special instructions for federal employees who may be in need of those. The other little bit of concern is some of the federal money that is coming in for the hurricane recovery. Other than that, as the reports that I've read, things that I've been able to figure out, there's not a huge impact on North Carolina yet. And there may not be. Our budget is in good shape. We are able to pay all our bills. Under our Constitution, we can't have a shutdown. So, you know, we're okay. Our teachers are going to be paid. Our police officers are going to be paid, those kind of things. So I think the real effect direct effect in North Carolina is going to be pretty minimal.
There's a lot of effects, actually, and they're starting to come to the surface. We know that, and there's everything that from practical things like small business and home loans aren't being processed. EPA is not processing environmental approvals for real estate projects. Their lab has stopped testing water samples for Gen X. Our federal parks are falling into disrepair. Even our immigration courts, the whole purpose of this, right, is Trump's plan to try to build a wall, and the immigration courts that are in the business of meting out justice to the people who are trying to either stay in this country or are being forcibly kicked out of this country are not able to meet. I mean, there's a long and growing list, and we're facing very soon, if this goes on to the end of the month, the problem of actual poor people who are reliant upon SNAP, which we used to call food stamps, going hungry. I mean, this is a big business. There are 8,000 or so workers in North Carolina who had a business. I talked the other day to a TSA employee who's been all the bigwigs have been furloughed, but this person's a line worker. They have to go to work every day. They're not getting paid. They're supposed to get paid this Saturday. If they don't get paid, a lot of people are, you know, you can say, oh, you can go apply for unemployment insurance, but that doesn't mean you're going to get it, or you're going to get as much as you were making in your salary, or when you're going to get it. There's a lot of people who got to pay the rent, and they got some problems.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, you
too. Thanks, guys. You too.